We begin with some breaking news about GW Bridgegate, the closing of local access lanes in Fort Lee to the bridge for commuters for a few days in September. The question has been, was it political payback against the Democratic mayor of Fort Lee for not supporting Governor Christie for reelection, right? So the Record newspaper of Northern New Jersey has just broken some new details, and New Jersey Public Radio reporter Matt Katz, who covers the Christie administration, has been checking them out. Hi, Matt. Good morning. What's new?
Good morning, Brian. I just got obtained those same emails, and they're pretty explosive, to be honest with you. We thought the governor had told us that nobody in his senior staff, that he spoke to everybody in his senior staff, and nobody knew about these lane closures in September. And these emails indicate otherwise. They indicate that his campaign manager, who used to be on his senior staff, knew about it. It indicates that another person, Bridget Ann Kelly, and his senior staff, said in August, 2 weeks before the lane closures that caused these major traffic jams, she wrote an email to Christie's contact at the Port Authority, Christie's appointee at the Port Authority, David Wildstein, and she wrote, "Time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee."
No. It's as specific and direct as that? Time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee?
That's correct. And a minute later, the response from Wildstein was, "Got it."
Who is this person again who wrote that email?
Her name is Bridget Ann Kelly. She is the deputy chief of staff for legislative and intergovernmental affairs, meaning she's in charge of dealing with local governments and the legislature and everything else. That is a senior staff position. She took over for Bill Stepien, who became the campaign manager, who left the administration to become Christie's campaign manager, and 2 weeks ago was named to the Republican Governors Association, which Christie is the chairman of. And yesterday, Stepien became the head of the Republican Party in the state of New Jersey. And he's also is evident all over these emails. In September, right after the lane closures, he calls the mayor of Fort Lee, who had complained about these massive traffic jams. He calls the mayor an idiot, and he says, "Win some, lose some." Fort Lee, I mean, Democrats up to this point have been saying that this was in retaliation to the mayor of Fort Lee, who didn't endorse Christie for reelection. And the Christie administration has denied this up and down. But the Fort Lee and the mayor are described as Serbia, meaning they're outliers in these emails. It'll be a tough November for this little Serbian. That's what Wildstein writes to Stepien.
Serbia. And the timeline of this coming in August, time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee. Did that come after anything particular had happened? Was it specifically that the mayor of Fort Lee, who's a Democrat, by the way, you wouldn't even necessarily expect to endorse the Republican gubernatorial candidate, had he just declined to endorse or endorse Christie's Democratic opponent, Bob Rabono? Can you tell from this, and I realize this just came out like within the hour, but can you tell from this whether there was something specific that precipitated this email in August?
No, it's unclear. I mean, it kind of almost starts in the middle of the conversation, it seems. But we do know in August, that's when the governor was getting a ton of Democratic endorsements. That's when they were really pouring in. He got almost, I believe, 60 endorsements from elected Democratic officials. And clearly, this mayor, along with others, were wooed for their endorsements. And they were, whatever this mayor did, whether it was he didn't endorse the governor or something else, they were out to get him, it seems. I mean, when the traffic happened, an unknown recipient, an unknown person texts David Wildstein and says, "Is it wrong that I'm smiling?" "No," Wildstein writes in response. The person writes, "I feel badly about the kids, I guess." This is referring to the fact that there were kids stuck in traffic on the way to their first day of school. Then listen to this. Wildstein responds, "They are the children of Buono voters," referring to Barbara Buono, the Democratic candidate who is running against Christie.
Wow. Talking that way about New Jersey kids. Who wrote that email?
Wildstein wrote, "They are the children of blown out voters." It's unclear from because there's parts redacted for unknown reasons. It's unclear who he was interacting with.
And Wildstein, will remind people, is Christie's childhood friend who went on to be his man at the Port Authority, who has since resigned as a result of what was already revealed about this GW Bridgegate, right?
He has since resigned. These documents, we believe, some of these documents come from him because he was under a subpoena, and he is scheduled to appear and testify tomorrow in the state legislature. And
oh, really? So I guess the lawmakers have some new questions to ask him tomorrow now.
They certainly do, and it'll be interesting to see if he tries to plead the fifth or if he falls on the sword for the administration and doesn't say anything, or maybe he wants to spill the beans and say that this came from higher up and he was following orders.
And, of course, this has massive potential political implications since Chris Christie is believed to be the leading Republican presidential hopeful for 2016. Does it tie back to Chris Christie himself?
I mean, we know that Christie said, "I spoke to my senior staff and they've assured me that they were not involved." So we now know that either there is a possible failure of management here in that somebody lied to him and said that they weren't involved when they were, or that the governor was being not truthful with us. One of those things must be the case here. So either of those scenarios would certainly seem to be a problem for him politically.
And at very least, to the question of whether Christie is a bully, which is one that's going to dog him, and some people like his style and find it just very direct, and some people label it bullying, people working under him felt empowered to have this kind of relationship with the mayor of Fort Lee and the children who were stuck in the traffic, and to be kind of gleeful about it.
That's right. That's right. And they also mentioned other people. Steve Phillip, the mayor of Jersey City, who this week says he believes he may have been retaliated against for not endorsing the governor. He didn't get he had meetings canceled with Christie administration officials after he told them he wasn't going to endorse Christie last year. His name comes up in these emails as somebody who is just after the mayor of Fort Lee, as somebody who's on they don't use these words, but the indicates that he's on the naughty list, they don't like him almost as much as they don't like the mayor of Fort Lee. And Phillip told me yesterday that he thinks that there is also an issue with a bill he wants to get through the legislature that would save his taxpayers millions of dollars, and all of a sudden it's been stalled by Senate President Steve Sweeney, who's an ally of the governor. So we have a second North Jersey governor claiming political retaliation from Christie's office.
Now, when I heard that piece of it a few minutes before we went on the air, I was so surprised because we had Jersey City Mayor Steve Phillip on the show last month in conjunction with something else. And while he was here, because this GW Bridgegate story was breaking and it had to do with the mayor of Fort Lee, I asked him, well, has there been anything like this pertaining to you as a Democratic mayor who endorsed Barbara Bono? And he denied it. Listen.
You know, I think that perception exists around people, certainly around the Democratic Party and those Republicans that are more engaged and less engaged. I think that certainly is fair to say. I could just tell you from my personal experience, from somebody who hasn't endorsed him and hasn't had a particularly strong relationship personally, we still see when we ask for support for certain state projects, it's looked at on its merits.
I had asked him if there's a perception among mayors that there's a naughty and nice list in the governor's office, and he said, yeah, that perception exists, but the conclusion there, everything that he puts through in terms of a policy proposal is looked on its merits by the Christie administration. Now this new news breaking emerges, well, maybe not so much with respect to Steve Fuller.
You know, what we might be seeing here is that the damage that the governor is sustaining politically is empowering some critics to speak out a little louder. We've seen Republican legislators complain a little bit about him anonymously, which would, before they wouldn't even be quoted saying something like that. So there's, you know, this might have opened some floodgates here in hurting the governor and allowing his critics to go after him a little more vocally and divulge some of the issues that they may have had and they may have been before scared to talk about.
Right. And of course, there was no traffic jam, as far as we know, into the Holland Tunnel, which goes to Jersey City from Manhattan and back. Well, this is all very interesting. I guess we'll hear a little bit more about it since this is just breaking right now in the news coming up later this hour. But New Jersey Public Radio's Matt Katz checking out these documents that have been published just this morning by The Record, the newspaper from Bergen County and northern New Jersey generally. Some pretty shocking stuff here. And we are getting these documents up on our homepage. They are now up on our homepage. So listeners, if you want to read this for yourself, go to WNYC.org right on the homepage. You can follow what's been going on here and draw your own conclusions. Matt Katz, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian.
Good afternoon.
In early October 2010, Governor Chris Christie assembled reporters at the State House.
Approximately 30 days ago, I received information from Jim Weinstein, the executive director of New Jersey Transit, which called into great concern the projected cost of the ARC tunnel. At that time,
the ARC was a New Jersey transit tunnel under the Hudson River. It was going to ease commutes for most of northern New Jersey. Christie said he'd just learned it could go $2 to $5 billion over budget.
In light of that information, the executive committee has made a recommendation to me that the project be terminated.
But multiple sources say that's not what happened. Instead, they say Governor Chris Christie realized soon after he was elected that the fiscal promises he'd made during the campaign were impossible to keep. The new transportation commissioner was telling people there was no money for roads, and Christie had ruled out upping the gas tax. That would have been the kiss of death for a Republican with national ambitions. So Christie looked to the Port Authority.
And it's politics.
Robert Buzz Paswell is director of the University Transportation Research Center at the City College of New York.
They're using it to solve their budget problems in New Jersey more than, certainly more than New York.
By March of 2010, Christie had tapped State Senator Bill Baroni and a political blogger, David Wildstein, to the Port Authority. Neither had transportation experience. Wildstein's title was Director of Interstate Capital Projects. As such, he was in charge of the big money deals. One of the first things he did was start asking about the ARC money. Could New Jersey recoup the $2 billion the port was spending? What could they spend it on? The answer came back, it could be spent on roads.
They didn't have dedicated funding sources.
Tom Wright is executive director of the Regional Plan Association.
And so by canceling ARC, the governor was able to shift the resources to his priorities.
At the same time, Baroni and Wildstein were quietly inquiring about redirecting the ARC money at the Port Authority. Christie was meeting with the U.S. Transportation Secretary, Ray LaHood, assuring him there would be funding for the tunnel. 6 months later, Christie pulled the plug.
This decision is final. There is no opportunity for reconsideration of this decision on my part. I am done. We are moving on.
LaHood called Christie's explanation that he had canceled the project because of new information simply not accurate. At the Port Authority, Baroni and Wildstein worked quickly. The $2 billion was redirected to the Pulaski Skyway, a road owned by New Jersey, not the Port Authority. In a Senate hearing, Baroni provided a justification.
The Pulaski, we believe, will have a benefit to the current crossings at Lincoln, certainly at Lincoln, and at Holland. So we believe, you know, it'll be a marginal improvement there, but we're not.
That was on top of another almost $3 billion New Jersey would get from canceling the ARC deal to pay for other road projects, which meant Christie could fund his roads budget without raising the gas tax until well after 2016. At the same time, multiple sources say, Wildstein and Barone were working overtime to push other deals. The purchase of an old Army terminal near the Bayonne Bridge for $235 million bailed out the town of Bayonne, which was facing bankruptcy. Inside the Port Authority, sources say, the long-term value of the deal was sharply questioned. But a bankrupt town would have been a huge headache for Trenton. Heavily Democratic Bayonne and its surrounding county would support Christie in 2013. In nearby Harrison, there was another big project, the upgrade of the PATH station for $256 million. Barone personally pushed that one.
The folks who know me at the Port Authority has been one of the projects I spent a lot of time pushing and pushing and pushing, and that's a new train station in Harrison. Mayor McDonough, working across party lines, Mayor McDonough in Harrison points out that the Harrison train station needed work.
The Harrison mayor, a Democrat, would endorse Christie for re-election. The mayor denies there was any quid pro quo. I happen to like the guy, he told the Star-Ledger. There was also the Port Authority takeover of the money-losing Atlantic City Airport, far away from the Port of New York and New Jersey. All of these deals were unanimously approved by the Port Authority Board, a collection of politically connected businessmen and labor leaders. Many of these new projects were for roads and airports that have nothing to do with the Port Authority, says Buzz Paswell of the City College of New York.
It's the wrong thing to do. I mean, there are other ways that you can solve the budget problems by being honest with the people in the state, saying if you want to improve transportation facilities, it's going to cost more.
In an emailed statement, Governor Christie's spokesman, Michael Druniak, defended all the spending. These are major public infrastructure projects with lasting benefits, not just to a particular town, but to the entire port facility, New Jersey and New York's economic well-being. He added, without Governor Christie, the projects would not have gone forward. To pay for all these projects, the Port Authority needed more money. Just about its entire budget comes from airport fees and tolls.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen. I think we all know somewhere that this proposed increase is insane.
On a Friday afternoon in August 2011, just before the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, the Port Authority said it would raise tolls on the Hudson River crossings, in part to pay for the World Trade Center. The plan, multiple sources say, was orchestrated by Wildstein and Barone. But in a now familiar pattern, Christie, along with New York Governor Cuomo, issued a statement. The Port Authority has informed us of its proposal to dramatically increase its tolls on tunnels and bridges. The governors howled about the Port Authority, which they jointly control. Then the commissioners approved a somewhat lower increase, and sources familiar with the process say that was the plan all along. It was a significant new expense for motorists, but it wasn't, crucially, a tax. Some months later, Barone appeared at a hearing in Washington on the hikes before the late Senator Frank Lautenberg.
But respectfully, Senator, you only started paying tolls recently. For years, Senator, as a former commissioner of my agency, you received free E-ZPass.
With Wildstein seated behind him, Barone referred to a large black binder containing, apparently, dirt on Lautenberg.
Well, Senator, you took 284 trips for free in the last 2 years you had.
I want you to answer.
This was, sources say, Barone and Wildstein's M.O., to aggressively push their goals and embarrass their enemies. Even after Barone resigned over the George Washington Bridge traffic scheme, Christie defended him.
Senator Barone's tenure at the Port Authority, which I think was a very good one, where he fought very hard and got a lot of projects started for New Jersey that needed to be started for a long time, like the Bayonne Bridge and others. So I still have great respect for Senator Barone and consider him a good friend.
The Bayonne Bridge.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome. Welcome to a day of good news for New Jersey's economic future.
For years, this $1 billion plan had been a hugely important project to the construction unions. The New Jersey side would not support finalizing plans for the World Trade Center without an agreement on Bayonne. One of the commissioners voting for the Bayonne Bridge project was Raymond Pacino, the head of the laborers' union.
When we were campaigning last year, I met with all these groups and told them that this was going to be my highest transportation priority of this administration.
The project raises the bridge so larger ships can go underneath. Its merits had been debated for a decade, but Team Christie breathed new life into the project.
Please join me in welcoming him, our governor, our friend, my friend, our choice for governor for the next 4 years, Governor Chris Christie.
In the very first rally of Christie's reelection campaign, almost a year before the vote, Ray Pacino's union endorsed Chris Christie for governor. It was a big deal for Christie, who wanted to show he could attract labor support.
This campaign has just started, but I doubt that I'll have many better days than the day I was endorsed by the Labor International Union of North America.
It also helped scare off strong Democratic challengers. In the endorsement, Christie cited the Bayonne Bridge.
I am not in this race for re-election just for the hell of it. I am in this thing, and I believe you're in it with me, because we are going to win, and we are going to win big. And that's what it's all about.
For WNYC, I'm Andrea Bernstein.
There is one man who connects both scandals swirling around Governor Chris Christie, David Sampson, the chair of the Port Authority, who's also a successful lawyer. Now, WNYC's Andrea Bernstein has unearthed records showing Sampson's law firm has vaulted to the position of being one of the top lobbyists in New Jersey, and he's seen his municipal bond business increase fourfold under Governor Christie.
I, Chris Christie,
elected governor of the state of New Jersey.
When Chris Christie was sworn in for a second term this week, four top aides connected to Bridgegate weren't on the invite list. But one sat on the stage with the governor, a tall, elegant man, David Sampson, the chair of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, and a powerful lawyer and lobbyist. He's known by the honorific General after a stint as New Jersey's Attorney General. Sampson shows up several times in emails released in the Bridgegate investigation. Here's how. On a Friday morning in September, when the top New York appointee, Pat Foy, blew the whistle on the lane closure operation, Bill Baroni immediately emailed Sampson with the question, "General, can I call you now?" 4 hours later, David Wildstein, also a top New Jersey appointee, emailed to the governor's deputy chief of staff, quote, "Sampson helping us to retaliate." 4 days later, Sampson complains in an email about Foy, saying, quote, "He's playing in traffic. Big mistake." But while Christie said his other aides lied and were stupid, he stood by Sampson.
So I sat and met for 2 hours yesterday with Mr. Sampson, General Sampson, and again, I'm confident that he had no knowledge of this.
Sampson and Christie met when Christie was U.S. Attorney and Sampson was Attorney General. Christie later joked that he and Sampson had been threatened by a gang and that nothing brings you together like a death threat. Sampson became counsel for Christie's 2009 campaign, provided the campaign with offices, and became his transition chair. The two could be frequently seen over a meal at the now-closed Pal's Cabin, a classic Jersey steakhouse. By last November, when Christie took over the Republican Governors Association, widely believed to be the beginning of his 2016 presidential campaign, Sampson was one of the few that accompanied the governor to Tucson. More than one close Christie associate described Sampson as a father figure to the governor.
I'm convinced that he had absolutely no knowledge of this, that this was executed at the operational level.
Then the mayor of Hoboken spoke up. Don Zimmer accused the lieutenant governor of delivering a message from Christie: approve a development project in Hoboken or you won't get your Sandy aid. The Christie administration vigorously denies that any such thing happened. But Zimmer is sticking to her guns.
The bottom line is it's not fair for the governor to hold Sandy funds hostage for the city of Hoboken because he wants me to give back to one private developer.
The developer was the Rockefeller Group. Its lawyer was David Sampson's law firm. And the Port Authority, the bi-state agency Sampson chairs, had funded a $75,000 study that heavily favored the developer. That contract was okayed just as Sampson was taking over at the Port Authority. At least one other client with business interests that abut the Port Authority has retained Sampson's firm, the International Matex Tank Terminal in Bayonne.
It has the appearance of a significant conflict of interest.
Jameson Doig, a Dartmouth and Princeton professor, wrote the definitive book about the Port Authority, Empire on the Hudson.
It looks like a clear ethical violation.
At the same time he was chairing the Port Authority, Sampson's private business was growing. Records show his lobbying work increased from $40,000 a year to over $1 million a year. And his firm's legal work on municipal bond deals increased fourfold to underwriting deals worth $10 billion. What's disturbing to Doig about all of this is that Sampson made clear from the get-go that he would be pushing Governor Christie's interests at the Port Authority.
Chairman Sampson said that he thought the role of the chairman was to take the actions that the appointing governor asked him to do.
Multiple sources familiar with the Port Authority say Sampson muscularly inserted himself into the agency's operations, questioning decisions made by the New York side and communicating frequently with top Christie aides David Wildstein and Bill Baroni. John Wisniewski, the New Jersey assemblyman whose subpoenas broke the Bridgegate case wide open, says the documents reflect that.
The communication seemed to indicate that Mr. Sampson was at least very involved in some of the decision-making that may have led to the lane closure.
Wisniewski was troubled to learn of the growth in Sampson's private business while he was at the same time running what Sampson viewed to be a branch of New Jersey's government at the Port Authority.
It clearly looks very odd.
Neither a Christie spokesman nor the Port Authority responded to questions about why it was appropriate for Sampson to chair an authority that funded a study that benefited his own client, or why his own business had grown so much under Christie. Neither Sampson personally, his law firm, or his lawyer returned our calls. Sampson's own emails have been subpoenaed by New Jersey lawmakers. The Hoboken deal is being investigated by the FBI. For WNYC, I'm Andrea Bernstein.
Joe Capriglione assisted with the reporting on this story. You can see a chart showing the growth of Sampson's lobbying business at WNYC.org.
Chris Christie's top man at the Port Authority, David Sampson, is already embroiled in both scandals engulfing the New Jersey governor, Bridgegate, and an alleged threat to withhold Sandy aid to Hoboken over a real estate development. Now WNYC has learned Sampson worked to put together a deal to take over the Atlantic City airport at the same time his private law firm was quietly involved in that deal. As WNYC's Andrea Bernstein reports, Sampson's firm earned millions from New Jersey transportation agencies at the same time he was chairing the Port Authority.
When Chris Christie ran for governor, he pledged to work to revitalize the Atlantic City economy. It's a promise he kept.
I don't think anyone could say any longer that the folks in the state capital and north of there did not understand or care about the needs of South Jersey and Atlantic City.
The plan to take over the Atlantic City Airport was particularly important to South Jersey Democrats. It had been developed by Christie's predecessor, Democrat John Corzine, but was embraced by Christie. But aviation experts were dubious about the benefits to the Port Authority.
I was surprised.
When he heard of the plan, Mitchell Moss, director of NYU's Rudin Transportation Center, wondered why the Port Authority was buying a money-losing airport so far from the Port District, a 25-mile radius from the Statue of Liberty. At the time of the deal, only 29 flights a day were going in and out of the Atlantic City Airport.
That the Port Authority would invest in an airport when the region's airports that it currently has jurisdiction on are so in need of investment. It seemed like a major diversion of investment resources to a peripheral location.
But it was important to the governor and his top man at the Port Authority, his friend and political confidant, David Sampson, made it clear from the get-go he wanted it done. According to sources familiar with the Port Authority, Sampson told his top aides, Bill Baroni and David Wildstein, go do it. Last March, David Sampson announced at a board meeting that the Port Authority would operate the Atlantic City Airport for the next 15 years.
This was first considered by the board back in September when we authorized a study.
Sampson recused himself from the vote, but he praised the deal.
There are great opportunities here, our consultants tell us and our aviation people tell us.
What Sampson didn't say publicly is that while he was chairing one party to the negotiation, his private law firm was working for the other party, the airport's operator, the South Jersey Transportation Authority. Records obtained by WNYC show that Wolf and Sampson was hired in July of 2010, just 2 months before he was nominated to head the Port Authority.
This is an operational arrangement that we've authorized today.
The Atlantic City Airport wasn't the only public transportation agency that Sampson's private law firm was working for. Wolf and Sampson was also working for New Jersey Transit, which is partly subsidized by the Port Authority, through cheap space at the Midtown bus terminal. Around the time Governor Christie appointed Sampson to chair the Port Authority, WNYC has learned, New Jersey Transit hired Wolf and Sampson for $1.5 million to put together an unspecified public-private partnership deal.
As the chairman of the Port Authority, David Sampson is essentially part of the governor's administration, a high-ranking appointee.
That's Assemblyman John Wisniewski, the chair of the Assembly Transportation Committee, who's led the Bridgegate investigation. He says the tangle of financial relationships erodes trust in government.
Having high-level appointees essentially help themselves to opportunities that aren't available to other people can lead to a suspicion that things are not being done for the right reason.
We repeatedly asked Sampson, his law firm, and his private PR firm about all these potential conflicts of interest. None would comment. But his PR firm has said in the past that he holds himself to the highest ethical standards, and the Port Authority has set up a committee to look into ethical conflicts. The connections go deeper. Sampson traveled with Chris Christie to the Republican Governors Association meeting in Arizona in November, when Christie assumed the helm. New Jersey Public Radio's Matt Katz was there. He caught up with Christie in the hallway.
Who were you meeting with this week? You know, you were only with us for a little bit of time, so what else were you doing?
I spend most of my time with donors. My main job is to raise money, and so I spent most of my time with donors, spent some time with
Records now show the Republican Governors Association attracted big checks from donors who do transportation business in New Jersey, like Bombardier, which makes both the Newark AirTrain and New Jersey Transit trains. A spokeswoman for that company, which once retained Wolf and Sampson as a lobbyist, says it gives equally to both the Democrat and Republican Governors Associations because it wants to raise its profile with state governments. All of this might have remained behind the scenes had not David Sampson's name appeared in the Bridgegate documents. In hearings last month, Assemblyman Wisniewski asked David Wildstein's lawyer, Alan Zegas, what Wildstein had meant in an email sent to Christie's deputy chief of staff.
New York side gave Fort Lee back all three lanes this morning. We are appropriately going nuts. Sampson helping us to retaliate. Who is Sampson?
Because I see the language, sir, and I would advise Mr. Wildstein once again to assert his rights of silence under the federal and New Jersey constitutions.
Wisniewski had subpoenaed Wildstein's documents that related to Bridgegate. He asked Wildstein why he'd submitted a set of text messages referring to a meeting between Sampson and the governor weeks before the lane closures on the George Washington Bridge.
That document refers to a meeting with Port Authority Chairman David Sampson, does it not?
On the advice of counsel, I assert my right to remain silent.
And that also refers to a meeting with the governor of the same date.
The date was August 23rd. We don't know if Bridgegate was discussed, but the Record newspaper has reported one topic was whether United Airlines would start flying to the Atlantic City Airport. In November, Christie held a press conference with the top elected South Jersey Democrat, Steve Sweeney, and David Sampson, to announce United would indeed start flying to Atlantic City. David Sampson's law firm continues to represent the South Jersey Transportation Authority to this day. For WNYC, I'm Andrea Bernstein.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WNYC. Last month, after Hoboken's mayor claimed the Christie administration had withheld Sandy aid because she didn't support a redevelopment project, the governor's office fought back. In a series of press releases, they said Hoboken had asked for more than its fair share. They said funding was limited, and they argued that other communities were hit harder by the storm. But now an investigation by WNYC and the New Jersey Spotlight's Scott Gurian has found that Hoboken's mayor was right. The city was shortchanged.
When Sandy's floodwaters rushed into densely populated Hoboken, more than 85% of the city was plunged into darkness. At the Marion Towers senior housing complex, it was a scene of chaos, with backup generators running on empty, and only the building's superintendent to help 150 residents. Tony Sciarra was one of dozens milling about the lobby.
Well, it's pretty bad. You know, there's no elevators. We have no power. We have no heat. And there's a lot of elderly people in the building that really need help.
At several of the city's fire stations, generators failed after taking on water. So firefighters had no way to recharge their equipment. Also, Fire Chief Richard Blohm says his entire communication system stopped working.
Our repeater system looks down on the rest of Hoboken. Well, when the power went out, their backup generator was supposed to kick in, and it did not. All of my fire companies were out, and I had no way of communicating with them.
City officials couldn't communicate either, so they resorted to posting handwritten messages on bulletin boards around the city. All this was a transformative moment for Hoboken Mayor Dawn Zimmer. As she said in her State of the City address a few months later, these concerns would become a driving force of her administration.
Hurricane Sandy caused massive damage from flooding, but it also highlighted the vulnerabilities in our power system. So in addition to planning to protect the city from flooding, we are also preparing the city to be more resilient during power outages.
When the Christie administration announced early last year that it was accepting applications through the Hazard Mitigation Grant Program for towns and cities to reduce their vulnerabilities to future storms, Hoboken jumped at the chance. It submitted a $1.7 million application to purchase 12 generators at critical locations, including police and fire departments, the ambulance squad, and the city hall. In October, Hoboken heard back from the state that it would receive just $142,000 through that program. Speaking with WNYC early last month, Mayor Zimmer wondered whether Hoboken had been shortchanged because she didn't endorse Governor Christie's reelection.
Yeah, you know, I know the shore is very important, but, you know, Hoboken is kind of the urban jewel of New Jersey, and we had a lot of damage.
Days later, Zimmer came forward with her allegation that senior members of the Christie administration had threatened withholding Sandy aid if she didn't support a redevelopment project favored by the governor. Those charges are now under investigation by the federal prosecutor and the FBI. Governor Christie's storm czar, Mark Ferzan, held a hastily called phone conference to deny the claim that politics played any role in the distribution of Sandy aid.
There's some suggestion out there that Hoboken has not received grant funding that other communities have.
In fact, he said the city had received nearly $70 million in recovery and rebuilding aid. But much of that aid went to individuals and was distributed by the federal government rather than the state. Ferzan also said there simply isn't enough money to approve every request.
I'm scratching my head a little bit about, you know, any community that's getting the short end of the stick, other than to say that I understand we've got very limited resources at our disposal to date.
That's because the state got $250 million in requests for generators, but only had $25 million to go around. To decide who would get help, officials created a complex ranking process where applicants like Hoboken were given points for a variety of factors. The group Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility obtained a copy of the internal score sheet that was used and shared it with WNYC. Mark Moriello, a former commissioner at the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection, has scored these sorts of grant proposals for many years, and he reviewed it for us. He says the way the state ranked the applications was convoluted and involved many different and unorthodox calculations that made the results illogical at best and subject to manipulation.
It just seems to me that this thing by nature creates a lot of opportunity to really make funding decisions that might not be in the best interest of the state when you look at it as a whole, one community over another.
WNYC analyzed the state's score sheet and found dozens of errors and irregularities. For example, tiny towns like Mount Arlington and Old Tappan were awarded the same amount as Hoboken, even though the rankings are supposed to award points for density, population, and disaster history. Nutley and Morristown received hundreds of thousands of dollars more than they should have, according to the state's own rules. Meanwhile, Belmar and Atlantic City, which have long histories of flooding, didn't get any money at all. Moriello says the ranking factors seem pretty straightforward on their surface, but the process overall would have been easy to tamper with.
And obviously, the more of these columns you have, the more opportunities you have to check off a box and add weight or points to a certain proposal.
Even if you accept the state's scoring methodology, in many cases, the math is simply wrong. In Hoboken's case, we did the scoring ourselves based on the state's own rules. We found the city should have received $681,000, or possibly up to $840,000, according to the methodology used, rather than the $142,000 it was originally awarded.
While you raise some questions about what you think could be problems with the process, we're still in the process.
Department of Environmental Protection spokesman Larry Raganese says state officials may have made some mistakes in their scoring, but that it's wrong to raise questions at this point, since he claims they're still in the midst of their work.
You're trying to do a critical analysis of a program and funding that's going out to towns on energy resiliency when it hasn't been completed. So I don't know how you would do that.
Although no money has actually gone out yet, state officials told towns how much they'll receive back in the fall, and several even sent out press releases announcing the decisions. Towns have also already submitted detailed plans for how they'll spend the money, and many say they understood the decisions to be final. Hoboken officials are convinced they were shortchanged. A spokesman for the city released a statement in response to our findings. "This investigation adds to the growing body of evidence," he said, "that the Christie administration's process of distributing Sandy funds has been flawed, politicized, and subject to abuse." For WNYC, I'm Scott Gurian.
That report is part of a Sandy Rebuild collaboration with New Jersey Spotlight.
Step 1, stagecraft. The report was commissioned by the governor. It was written by Christie allies. And the report's conclusion was leaked to the New York Times with approval from the governor's office on Monday. By Thursday, Christie attorney Randy Mastro held a news conference at his law offices high above Midtown Manhattan. Reporters had 1 hour to read a 300-page report with thousands of pages of exhibits before asking questions. And who controlled the press conference? One of Christie's spokesmen.
Step 2, distract with sex. The report prominently featured a salacious detail that campaign manager Bill Stepien became personally involved with Bridget Ann Kelly. She's the one who wrote, "Time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee." The report also said, high up, that it was Stepien who had broken off the relationship. The report concluded the breakup may have had some bearing on Kelly's state of mind. It became an instant tabloid headline, and it laid the basis to discredit anything Kelly might say later.
Step 3, attack your critics. The report discredits Hoboken Mayor Don Zimmer. Zimmer had said the lieutenant governor threatened to withhold Sandy aid if she didn't approve a development project. Christie's lawyers spend half of the report's executive summary countering Zimmer's claims and her credibility, even including still photographs from video taken at one of her public appearances.
Step 4, frame the questions. None of the top five biggest names in the Bridgegate scandal were interviewed. Among those are David Sampson, Christie's mentor, who is currently serving the governor as chairman of the Port Authority. Sampson is referred to in previously released documents as being the one who would retaliate against the official who finally reopened the lanes. But that's never explained. Numerous other references to Sampson's involvement are also left unexplained, as is the governor's reason for accepting this noncompliance from Sampson, his appointee.
Step 5. Use the phrase, "does not recall." The lawyers take the most potentially damning new accusation and immediately refute it, then dismiss it. They say that the governor's appointee at the Port Authority, David Wildstein, had said he told the governor about the lane closures while they were happening. Wildstein said the conversation occurred when the pair were together at Ground Zero on September 11, 2013. But then the report quickly notes that the governor doesn't remember this, that there were 4,000 people there, and that even if Wildstein had said anything, it wouldn't have been remarkable.
Step 6, propose reforms. Say there was nothing systemically wrong in Christie's office, but propose reforms anyway. That way, you look like the good guy.
Cap it all off with a friendly interview on ABC at the governor's home before a national audience.
For WNYC, I'm Andrea Bernstein.
And I'm Matt Katz. Republican Chris Christie wanted to win his re-election last year, and he wanted to do it big. To that end, he needed Democrats. To get Democrats, he needed Democratic officials to endorse him. By collecting these endorsements, he could prove himself as a Republican who could win in a blue state, and therefore a perfect candidate for president in 2016.
It's not easy to stand up and endorse somebody in the other party for governor. And so I want to thank them for standing up for what they believe is right for their citizens and not putting their party before the people they represent. They're heroes, and they deserve your applause.
In Spring Lake last summer, Christie celebrated the local Democrats who endorsed him. New documents now indicate how his staff, both on the campaign and at the state capitol, helped to make those endorsements happen. The documents were compiled from thousands of pages that were released last week as part of an internal review Christie ordered into the scandals enveloping his administration.
We found that Governor Christie.
Christie's lawyer Randy Mastro maintains the documents exonerate the governor. But the first record of the intense focus on endorsements comes at a meeting in Christie's office at the State House in January 2013 that was ostensibly about Sandy funding. This was when Christie asked Hoboken Mayor Don Zimmer for her endorsement.
He talked about how we've had a great relationship and we've really worked together and that he would really like to have my support, and he asked for my endorsement.
Zimmer was noncommittal. So afterward, Christie's staff and his taxpayer-funded office worked in concert with his reelection campaign to do what they could do to get Zimmer on their side. For example, they fast-tracked meetings with state officials who Zimmer wanted to meet with. But by July 2013, 4 months before the election, Zimmer was still noncommittal. Campaign manager Bill Stepien was getting anxious. "We're approaching a point in time where we have the so what's it going to be," he wrote to a colleague. "Are you with us or are you against us?" Carl Golden was a press secretary for two Republican governors in New Jersey. He says that politics and government are always intertwined.
Only the most naive among us would believe that politics is not a major element in any governor's office, politics and political considerations. It's always there. The key is how discreet is the office going to be, or something created by the governor's office, in dealing with that.
Team Christie was not discreet about the Hoboken mayor. When campaign manager Stepien learned that Mayor Zimmer wasn't endorsing anyone, he was furious, complaining to a colleague that they had been kissing her ass all these years for nothing. At an August event in Hoboken, in which reality TV's Cake Boss endorsed Christie, Zimmer wanted to come by. But Christie, quote, strongly agreed with a decision by his staff to tell her to stay away. In November, Christie won re-election by 22 points. Then the Bridgegate scandal broke, and Zimmer told WNYC she wondered if she lost out on Sandy aid because she didn't endorse the governor.
With 2020 hindsight, I mean, in the context that we're in right now, you can always look back and say, like, okay, it was a retribution, but, like, you know, so I think probably all mayors are reflecting right now and thinking about it, but I really hope that that's not the case.
Another mayor wondered the same thing when lanes to the George Washington Bridge from his town inexplicably closed last September. The speculation continues to be that the Bridgegate scandal evolved from a plan to retaliate against Fort Lee Mayor Mark Sokolich, who didn't endorse Christie.
He was not somebody that was on my radar screen in any way, politically, professionally, or in any other way, until these stories came out in the aftermath of the closing.
That was what Christie said about Sokolich after Bridgegate broke. But internal documents indicate that his team was going after Sokolich hard. His name first showed up in an email sent in January 2013 by a government official, Pete Sheridan, to five of his employees in the Intergovernmental Affairs Unit of the governor's office. The email had a list of 21 Democratic mayors who state workers were supposed to secure endorsements from. Intergovernmental Affairs was technically in charge of making sure mayors' needs were met by Christie's office. But now that the campaign was on, the workers had to also go out and get those mayors' endorsements. Sheridan told the state employees that they should only be doing this on their own time since it was political work, but he sent those instructions during work hours on a Thursday. And the documents show one of the employees met with the Fort Lee mayor on a Tuesday for lunch, in which the topic of endorsements came up. It was an official government meeting. Golden, the former Republican press secretary, explains how it works.
That mayor doesn't need a translator to understand what's going on. That the governor's office is in a position to help, the governor's office is conversely in a position to harm, depending on the outcome of these conversations.
Former Democratic Governor John Corzine kept a wall separating government meetings and political endorsements, former aide said, with endorsement asks happening in the early mornings at diners. Braxton Plummer was the director of intergovernmental affairs for Corzine. Reports of how the office was used by Christie shocked him.
Everybody stayed on message to do the appropriate thing.
on a day-to-day basis from 9 to 5. We operate as a government, so there was no time to really play the side.
In August of last year, top government aide Bridget Ann Kelly checked to see if the Fort Lee mayor had decided to endorse Christie. He hadn't. The next morning, she wrote the famous "Time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee" email. Christie's spokesman sent WNYC a statement from the governor's lawyer, Randy Mastro, who reiterated that government staff volunteered to do the campaign work on their own personal time. A lawyer for the state Republican Party said that campaign workers who also work for government are told to clearly identify which hat they are wearing and when. For WNYC, I'm Matt Katz.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WNYC. In a 345-page report on the Bridgegate scandal, Governor Christie's lawyers say flat out there is no evidence of any cover-up within the governor's office. But WNYC's Andrea Bernstein has been combing through the thousands of pages of exhibits, and she finds when it comes to a possible cover-up, the report leaves more questions than answers.
The entire story of Bridgegate might not have emerged if not for a detailed and furious email written by the usually measured executive director of the Port Authority, Pat Foy. In it, Foy charges the hasty and ill-advised decision to close lanes at the George Washington Bridge endangered public safety and broke federal and state laws.
And I made the decision immediately to reverse it. I was in my office early, drafted the email with some care and sent it out.
Foy sends it to, among others, the New Jersey deputy director, Bill Baroni, the former Republican state senator who Christie's described as a good friend. It also goes to the chair of the Port Authority, David Sampson, a close Christie confidant. Within minutes, Baroni forwards the email to Sampson with a note. Can I call you now? An hour later, Baroni emails Foy. There can be no public discourse. Later that morning, Baroni forwards Foy's email without comment to Christie's director of authorities. Christie's lawyer, Randy Mastro, says the governor's office behaved appropriately.
Some of them became aware of the lane realignment, inquired of Port Authority representatives, and were told this was a legitimate traffic study.
Even so, the next week, anxiety levels start to rise. Reporters are asking questions about why the lanes were abruptly closed. Baroni texts the Christie appointee who organized the closures, David Wildstein. We could schedule a meeting to stave off reporters. Separate emails show Sampson is deeply troubled the story's hitting the press. He accuses Foy of playing in traffic, bad mistake. In early October, the Wall Street Journal prints Foy's email. Christie would later say that's when he learned of the closures.
And I said to two former federal prosecutors, my chief of staff and my chief counsel, find out for me what's going on here.
Only Baroni and Wildstein, not Foy or the Port Authority professional staff, are questioned by Christie's men.
They came back and said, this is a legitimate traffic study.
But the explanation wasn't adding up for a growing chorus of Democratic lawmakers who were aware that the Christie administration had spent a great deal of time offering both carrots and sticks to Democrats to get their endorsements. In mid-October, State Senator Loretta Weinberg, who represents Fort Lee, shows up at the Port Authority meeting to question the official account.
Either there was a traffic study or there wasn't. If there was, where is it? What did they hope to accomplish? And the silence that we get from the Port Authority leads to people's conjecture.
Christie's Director of Authorities, Regina Eggia, is also there, observing. She sends a report to all of Christie's top staff, noting Weinberg's presence. Questions ensued on Fort Lee, she writes, but holding to script, of all under review. Agia puts quotes around that last part, all under review.
Any other explanation?
The governor's press secretary, Michael Druniak, starts skipping the chain of command and forwarding reporters' inquiries about the lane closures straight to Christie's chief of staff. A new high level of is hitting the fan tonight on the Fort Lee GWB issue, Druniak writes. Maybe you should know about it. Yet, to reporters, Druniak offers a message that doesn't reflect the behind-the-scenes commotion. He writes, for goodness sake, the governor of the state of New Jersey does not involve himself in traffic studies. Assemblyman John Wisniewski, the lead Bridgegate investigator, says all these communications aren't normal.
They had an interest in the lane closure. They had an interest in the inquiries about the lane closure. And they had an interest in what was happening to mollify or cover up what had happened in the aftermath.
At the end of November, Wisniewski called Christie's top man in the Port Authority, Bill Baroni, to testify.
Well, I appreciate you being here, Mr. Baroni.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
Your valiant attempts to change the topic as to...
Baroni's words, which we now know are largely false, have been crafted by three top Christie aides and the top aide to Sampson. According to the Mastro report, there's a conference call a week before the testimony. Over at the Port Authority, a lawyer with deep ties to Christie coaches Baroni. In the State House, three top staffers pore over the testimony, marking it up. One of them, Christie's counsel, makes two recommendations. According to the Mastro report, apologize to the people of Fort Lee and don't be combative.
What do you say to them?
Mr. Baroni, we are here to talk about why it is that those lanes were shut down
I
and Fort
you.
Lee was not told and created major
you.
Havoc.
I have told you.
Because
and I have
that's
told
a
you.
Major failure on the part of
I
the Port Authority.
I have told you repeatedly, Assemblywoman, that there were communication breakdowns with the borough of Fort Lee, communication breakdowns internally. You have yet to answer
your,
the question.
Your exec-
the Mastro report says the three top Christie aides watched the testimony in the governor's office, though the report doesn't mention it. So did the governor.
A mistake was made. And I think the senator admitted that from the testimony I heard.
Behind the scenes, there's relief. After the testimony, Baroni texts Wildstein, Trenton feedback? Wildstein responds, they were very happy, said you did great. Stepien, the campaign manager, also texts Baroni, hey, great job yesterday. I wanted to thank you. Wildstein writes to Christie's spokesman, Michael Druniak. Most importantly, Gov was not brought up in this. A week later, that changes when New Jersey Public Radio's Matt Katz asks Christie about the lane closures.
I worked the cones, actually, Matt. Unbeknownst to everybody, I was actually the guy out there. I was in overalls and a hat, so I wasn't. But I actually was the guy working the cones out there. You really are not serious.
Now things move quickly. The next day, Wildstein's buddy, the Port Authority Police Union chief, offers a cover story to reporters that the lane closures were his idea. That turns out to be false. That night, Wildstein has dinner with the spokesman, Michael Druniak. According to the Mastro report, at the dinner, Wildstein tells Druniak that he told the governor about the lane closures while they were happening, and that two of Christie's top staff, Bridget Ann Kelly and Bill Stepien, knew about them. The next day, Druniak tells Christie. The governor says it's time for Wildstein and Baroni to go. Christie himself edits the press statement, thanking Wildstein for his service. A week later, Christie faces the press to announce Baroni's resignation. He downplays its significance and says his top man at the Port Authority was planning on leaving anyway.
So, Bill Baroni, Senator Baroni has characterized this as a mistake. I am not curious. Believe me, I've heard more about this than I ever wanted to hear.
Christie doesn't mention Kelly and Stepien, but says he's satisfied no one else is involved.
And I've made it very clear to everybody on my senior staff that if anyone had any knowledge about this, that they needed to come forward to me and tell me about it, and they've all assured me that they don't.
3 weeks later, when the email, time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee, emerges, the governor steps forward.
Well, let me tell you, everybody, I was blindsided yesterday morning.
Christie apologizes to the people of New Jersey and the people of Fort Lee.
I am embarrassed and humiliated by the conduct of some of the people on my team.
Christie says Bridget Kelly lied to him, and that's why he fired her. After 4 months of a concerted effort by members of his senior staff to keep the story quiet, he hires a lawyer to get to the bottom of it. But the so-called exhaustive report released in March still leaves questions about what the governor knew about the lane closures and when. For WNYC, I'm Andrea Bernstein.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WNYC. Phone records obtained by WNYC contradict sworn testimony by a top Christie aide. The records show 12 text messages were sent between Governor Christie and a staff member during peak moments in a hearing about the lane closures. And as a timeline constructed by WNYC's Andrea Bernstein shows, they also undermine Governor Christie's own story that the scandal was so unimportant to him that he barely paid attention.
Until now, in thousands of pages of documents released by the legislature and Christie's own legal team, there's been just one mention of a text message to Governor Christie about the lane closures. That one text was revealed by incoming Chief of Staff Regina Ejia, who was questioned under oath last summer by State Senator Loretta Weinberg.
Do you have a copy of that text that you might have sent to the governor?
I do not.
If, in fact, you may have texted the governor about that, why would you not have been able to supply it?
I did not retain it.
Ejia said she deleted it. She couldn't remember when. When questioned in August, the governor said he had no recollection of it.
It obviously was something of no moment or no import.
But phone records provided to the legislature by AT&T show 12 exchanges between the governor and a top aide on December 9th, 2013. That was the day the official story began to unravel, and details of a politically motivated traffic jam on the George Washington Bridge began to come under sharp focus in sworn testimony to the New Jersey Assembly. In the testimony, Port Authority Executive Director Pat Foy called the closures aberrational, unprecedented, odd, and shameful. And he said the pretense for the lane closures was made up.
Was there a traffic study? I'm not aware of any.
You're not aware of any traffic study?
No, sir.
It's impossible to know what was said in the text between Christie and Ejia. AT&T says it no longer has records of the content of those messages. And neither Ejia's lawyer nor Christie's lawyer, Randy Mastro, responded to repeated requests for comment. But a timeline put together by WNYC shows a close correlation between key moments of the testimony and when the texts were sent. First up that morning last December was Port Authority Bridge and Tunnel Director Cedric Fulton. He testified that Christie aide David Wildstein had called him on a Friday to inform him the Fort Lee lanes would be closed the following Monday.
And what did you ask him?
First, I asked him whether or not he had communicated his intent to the executive director.
And what was his response?
Don't worry about that. We will take care of it.
Wildstein did not take care of that. As Fulton testified, contrary to usual procedures, the plan was hidden from motorists, the police, and top Port Authority officials. Around the time Fulton was explaining this, Christie sent the first of the 12 text messages exchanged that day with Regina Ejia. A bit after that, Robert Durando, the general manager of the George Washington Bridge, testified the bridge closures were unprecedented. But when asked by Assemblyman John Wisniewski why he went ahead anyway and closed them, Durando expressed a fear of crossing Christie's number two man at the authority.
I was concerned about what Mr. Wildstein's reaction would be if I did not follow his directive. Mr. Wildstein have the ability to terminate your employment? I suspect he does.
Minutes later, Ejia sent two more texts to the governor, who immediately responded. Later that afternoon, Assemblyman Wisniewski threatened to subpoena Christie's top staffers at the Port Authority. That was the time of the last text of the day from Ejia to Christie. All this isn't really surprising. The two were communicating on a day of testimony important to a lot of people in Trenton, New York City, and Albany. But until now, a top Christie aide has maintained under oath there was just one text, and Christie's lawyers have said there were none. Instead of a governor too busy to pay attention to traffic jams, the existence of the texts suggests an engaged Governor Christie, keeping a watchful eye on developments as the scandal unfolded. For WNYC, I'm Andrea Bernstein.
See a minute-by-minute timeline of the Christie texts at WNYC.org.
A year ago January, almost no one had ever heard of David Wildstein.
Well, let me just clear something up, okay? About my childhood friend, David Wildstein.
He'd been an anonymous political blogger, ran a rug business, and was the $150,000 a year director of Interstate Capital Projects at the Port Authority. Also, he'd gone to school with Chris Christie.
We didn't travel in the same circles in high school. You know, I was the class president and athlete. I don't know what David was doing.
That was the theme of a marathon news conference Christie held after the release of the explosive email from his top aide to Wildstein. Time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee. Christie distanced himself.
I don't even remember in the last 4 years even having a meeting in my office with David Wildstein. I may have, but I don't remember it.
Well, he did. We found Wildstein's schedules from his tenure at the Port Authority. We corroborated them through current and former Port Authority and Trenton staffers, records released by the governor's legal team and the New Jersey legislature, and other knowledgeable sources who declined to be named because of the ongoing federal investigations. Wildstein's calendars list 7 statehouse meetings with Governor Christie, but WNYC could only confirm 2. The logs were sometimes inconsistent with records provided by the Christie administration and reviewed by WNYC. But we did confirm that about once a month, Wildstein met with Bill Stepien, Christie's 2-time campaign director. He also met repeatedly with Michelle Brown, one of the governor's closest advisors. And from time to time, he met with another member of Christie's inner circle, Mike Duhaime.
My message as the political hack up here who runs political campaigns...
Duhaime was Rudy Giuliani's campaign manager when he ran for president in 2008. Ever since, he's been Chris Christie's political strategist.
The only thing that matters for a political party or for an organization like this is winning.
And win they did. Duhaime, the private consultant, and Stepien, the Christie staffer, were responsible for Governor Christie's meteoric rise. Wildstein was installed at the Port Authority to get things done, like an expensive project to raise the Bayonne Bridge, a key priority of the laborers' union.
Good morning, everybody. All right, first of all, today is about jobs.
The labor union endorsed Christie. Then there was the New Path Station.
Good morning, everybody. It's great to be back in Harrison.
The town's Democratic mayor endorsed Christie. The Port Authority offered Fort Lee Mayor Mark Sokolich free buses to the Edgewater Ferry. They gave the town 11 artifacts like burnt steel from the World Trade Center. Wildstein gave Sokolich a private tour of the Trade Center site. At the same time, Christie's political team was seeking an endorsement. Sokolich didn't seem to get the message. It's now 8 weeks until Election Day 2013.
211 Foley traffic is a nightmare. The GW Bridge is totally gridlocked.
On September 9th, the first day of school, buses were late, emergency vehicles were stuck, hour-long commutes stretched to 4. The lane closures continued. September 10th, September 11th. On the 11th, Wildstein joined Christie at an event at the World Trade Center for the 12th anniversary of the attacks. Before the ceremony begins, Wildstein can be seen in official photographs having an animated conversation with Christie, smiling and checking his BlackBerry. Wildstein would later say he spoke to the governor about the lane closures that day. Christie told his lawyer, Randy Mastro, he didn't recall any talk of lane closures.
And the fact of the matter is that a mention of a traffic problem would not have registered, been memorable, been meaningful. There are traffic problems and issues all the time at the bridges and tunnels.
But it was memorable enough to draw the attention of the Wall Street Journal. On November 7th, just after the election, the Journal ties the lane closures to Wildstein. The next day, Wildstein's calendar has the entire day blocked out with one word, Trenton. This is when Mike Duhaime, Christie's top political strategist, gets involved. He invites Wildstein for breakfast at Rocking Joe's in Westfield. We know from Duhaime's interview with Christie's legal team that the two discussed the closures and who was responsible. 6 days later, on a Sunday, there's a cryptic entry in Wildstein's calendar, CC, Christie's initials, Black Horse Tavern, Mendham. That's the small town where Christie lives. The meeting was set for 1 p.m., half a block from Christie's church. Christie's office says there was no meeting with the governor. This is the week there are a flurry of calls and meetings among Christie aides about the upcoming testimony of Bill Baroni, senior members of Christie's staff, former prosecutors, Prep Baroni. He tells lawmakers there was a traffic study gone awry. He's not well received.
That defies all logic, and nobody in this room believes that.
A few weeks later, Christie takes his first question on the lane closures.
I worked the cones, actually, Matt. Unbeknownst to everybody, I was actually the guy out there. I was in overalls and a hat, so I wasn't. But I actually was the guy working the cones out there. You really are not serious.
But the next Monday, December 9th, Port Authority staffers tell the legislature there was no traffic study. 3 days later, at 4 in the afternoon, the legislature subpoenas Wildstein and Baroni. Then everyone starts calling and texting and meeting with everyone else. Duhame, the strategist, calls Wildstein for 90 minutes until 1 in the morning. Duhame's next call is from Governor Christie at 7:30 a.m. At 8, there's an entry on Wildstein's calendar about an in-person meeting, W.S., Bill Stepien's initials, Mottville, where Wildstein lives. Bill Stepien is at this point getting ready to run Christie's presidential race. His lawyer denies the meeting occurred. The calls and texts between Stepien and Duhame, the two strategists, don't stop. Within just 1 hour, there are 17. Duhame explains it like this. He was trying to find out if Wildstein was sure that there were emails showing a top Christie staffer knew of the closures beforehand. He says Wildstein tells him 100%, and he relays that to Stepien. Still, Stepien asks Duhame to, quote, sit with him in person, ASAP. It isn't clear if Duhame and Wildstein later met because Wildstein's job and the calendar end here. All of this is going on from early in the morning until Christie walks out to the podium to face reporters.
Good morning.
He denies anyone on his staff had anything to do with the lane closures.
Yeah, I have absolutely no reason to believe that, Angie. And I've made it very clear to everybody on my senior staff that if anyone had any knowledge about this, that they needed to come forward to me and tell me about it. And they've all assured me that they don't.
On January 8th, the Bergen Record publishes the emails Wildstein gave to the legislature.
Well, let me tell you, everybody, I was blindsided yesterday morning.
The U.S. Attorney's investigation continues. For WNYC, I'm Andrea Bernstein.